Welcome to the European CME Forum podcast. European CME Forum is a not-for-profit organization that promotes multi-channel discussion on matters relating to European and global CME CPD. My name is Eugene Pozniak. I'm the program director of European CME Forum. In this episode, I'm joined by Ron Murray, an independent CME CPD consultant and author of the recent JECME article on the 13th annual European CME Forum. The focus of today's episode is the 13th annual European CME Forum, held virtually in November 2020. Hello, Ron. Thank you for joining us to discuss the previous meeting and to spend a bit of time to actually discuss European CME Forum, the past meetings and our plans for the future as well.
Delighted to be with you, Eugene. Good to see you again.
First off, your report is really, really useful, you know, on the 13th annual meeting. And we'll come to talk about that in a bit more detail in a bit. What did you think of it as a virtual meeting compared to sort of the previous live meetings that you've been to?
Well, the main thing that I think I got from it was the incredible amount of content that you managed to include there with, and perhaps it was because it was virtual, you were able to access people in real time all over the world. So I thought that was remarkable. And the breadth of content as well, it really was an incredible spectrum.
Yeah, no, that was certainly one of the upsides of going virtual, even though the planning was actually quite hair-raising, really. It was quite scary because, of course, we were always talking about going to Barcelona and you know, we had a large deposit at the venue there. It's a fantastic venue. We really, you know, we love the city. We love the space that we had there. And, of course, the risk of losing the deposit was a serious consideration for us. And even by, you know, we were thinking, would COVID have slowed down and allowed us to travel by November? You know, a lot of organizations were still sort of trying to hang on to that. But once we got to the end of summer and the imminent sort of second lockdown, it was clear that, yeah, this wasn't going away and we just had to move this virtually. And of course, starting to plan something around this time last year, September, saying we're definitely going virtual. You know, we really had to have all hands to the pump and, you know, the planning really took off. But with all that energy and also I think with our community realizing that, you know, the structure of meetings, the face of meetings was certainly going to change for the foreseeable future. I think, yeah, a lot of people sort of stepped up and offered their services. And I had some amazing conversations with members of the faculty and some supporters of the meeting who are referring us to various people. You know, the ideas were really sort of springing forth. And as you're saying, you know, people from all over the world, people who wouldn't normally come to a European CME forum, you know, because it's just sort of not in their scope of interest, a huge commitment to travel. I know we had some really interesting people who were able to create sessions, join the faculty and share their wisdom with us.
Well, a couple of things. Some people might say, well, number 13, unlucky for some, but I don't think it was unlucky. I think actually you gained a lot of positives out of this. But let's just go back a little bit and maybe you could explain a couple of things about the history of this. I've been in attendance for the last 8 or 9 years and enjoyed it all. But I've been aware of the forum ever since it started, even when I was working in the USA and I had colleagues who attended there, but I was never able to attend until I actually moved back to the UK after retirement. Why don't you give us an idea of, you know, where it all came from and why is it a forum and not a conference or a meeting?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, this whole thing started, I started working in CME in February 2000. And so in a way, I've been the oldest or longest serving CME professional in Europe. I've done nothing else but work in CME for over 20 years now. You know, I'm not a physician. I'm not. I don't have any positions anywhere else. All my functions, job functions, were directly related to being a CME provider. well, for the first 5 years, it was working really for other people. And then I could see that there was some sort of future for CME in Europe. It was starting to take off. And I just set up my own provider company. So I'm sort of managing director of CME Learning, which is a CME provider based in the UK, in Europe. And it was a huge commitment. We worked it out as a family that we wanted to do this. My wife supported me, which was great. But after a few months, all the sort of the promised business that I was expecting to get just wasn't coming through. And so this was a real challenge. And I wrote a white paper back then with for a publisher, Peter Llewellyn. It took off. People were very interested in this white paper on the state of CME in Europe. And he asked if I could do a number of presentations around the country. So we had them in Oxford, London, Manchester, and they were very well attended. He got very excited, saying, "This is fantastic. Everyone's so interested in CME." And it was after the third meeting. So, yeah, but no one is actually committed to it. Everyone's interested to it, but no one's doing it. And we so in this discussion, we sort of worked out, well, there are just different groups that sort of talked about CME in different ways, but there wasn't a single unified approach in Europe. You know, the marketing people were talking about education, CME in from a business perspective. The accreditors were talking about CME from their sort of the regulatory, the rules side. Medical societies were doing what they were doing, as CME didn't see any overlap with anyone else, and the professional providers really didn't sort of exist. So, and it really came out from that conversation. We said, well, why don't we get all these players together and actually start comparing and contrasting our opinions on what CME is? And really from that, we say, well, what, like a forum, like an old sort of, you know, Roman forum where people would go down to their city center and actually share ideas. And in those early days, we said, well, let's just run everything by topic. And we should say, actually, you can go to the website, cmeforum.org, and you can actually see the programs of all our meetings since then, including this first meeting. You know, we had a load of heads of accreditation bodies, heads of grant offices. We had very influential people coming to the meeting, just really out of interest. And it wasn't the first meeting. That was going to be the only meeting. And we had 2 days of very lively discussion and debate. And it was even at the end of the first day, people saying, "This is great. Where are we going next year?" And Peter and I just said, "Hang on, this is a one-off." And it was a huge amount of energy required to get all the people together. But there was the commitment there. We'll meet again the following year. And so the meetings started becoming regular fixtures. And it evolved from that time. And right from the beginning, and from the very first time when we structured the meeting, we said, you know, we're all sitting in those, you know, huge lecture theatres, row by row. I went to a conference actually just before the first European CME Forum, where chair of the meeting said, "Thank you very much. You know, see you next time. We're off." And the person in front turned round, and we started a conversation, and they were the most interesting person that I could have spoken to in the whole conference. And we were chatting away, and we both realized we had to get to the airport to get our flights. So in those 5 minutes, instead of 2 days and 5 minutes discussing things, you know, that networking, the ability to talk to your colleagues was lost. So we said, right from the first meeting, we're going to be in round tables, and there has to be some kind of icebreaker at the beginning where people actually talk to each other. So this has been in place right from the first meeting. And the most important, the sort of the maxim we go by for every meeting, which we try and bring in even with our virtual meetings, no one leaves the meeting without having all their questions answered. Whatever they are, there's got to be space around the meeting. And this was pretty innovative as a forum. I think there are plenty of organizations now running forums and things, but having this sort of mindset that people must have the opportunity to talk to each other, to talk to the faculty and at the meeting, so that whatever their question, big or small, that they get the answer to it. And because we get sort of between 100 and 150 people to the meetings, the faculty on site, and it's much easier to actually even see them privately, as well as being able to discuss it during the meeting itself. So in addition to the open Q&A, you know, you can meet someone over a coffee and even discuss things one-to-one.
Well, perhaps we can find out a little bit more later about, you know, how you thought you achieved the networking component of the forum when it was virtual. But one of the things that I've noticed from both my attendance and from looking back over the records of the forum, which you, as you well pointed out, are all freely available, is that you always have a theme. You provide a theme for the meeting, and that kind of is the framework on which everything else is built. So why don't you give us an idea of how did you sort of, first of all, what was the theme for the last one in 2020, and how did you go about structuring the meeting based on that theme?
Sure. Yeah, actually, we used to have the theme sort of behind the scenes for the first few meetings, and then we actually started having a title, and a visible theme, and it started when we asked the question, CME, what could it stand for? And that was a few years ago, and it really should be like a change management engine, which was sort of, we thought was quite clever, and it was quite a struggle to come up with meaningful themes after that. But because we were going virtual, so in 2020, actually the theme was European and global CME, what next? And that sort of lent itself quite nicely, because it really was, there was that feeling in the world with everything, COVID, what next? What is the new normal? What are we going to be doing after this? And with CME also, that's when we started talking about European and global CME as well, because going virtual meant that we could reach beyond our sort of normal European base. And actually, right from the beginning, we've always had an international component to the meeting. Yes, we focus on European CME, but we need to learn from each other. So literally anyone from around the world can not only contribute, but hopefully learn from participating in the meeting as well. So the theme, European and global CME, what next? And we asked, And always in the briefing sessions we have, any conversations with faculty members, session chairs, I do ask them to actually reflect on the theme and try and include that in their sessions. So that's why we get the lovely links between each of the sessions with the theme. So each of the speakers were linking what they saw of what was happening with CME from their standpoint, and just looking to the future and just trying to determine what the next steps were going to be.
So having moved to this virtual scenario, did you find that there was anything that you found beneficial for the forum from moving virtually?
I don't know if it was beneficial. I mean, what we were discussing earlier about having a more diverse faculty and being able to accommodate a much larger faculty was certainly the strongest benefits actually that came out of being virtual. And the ability to meet as well, because there were so many meetings that were cancelled or postponed as well. So that was a huge benefit. And we should look at actually the collateral that we got from the meeting. So obviously everything's going to be recorded. And we could actually play around a little bit with the technology. I mean, we're all very sort of new to what was available, but we partnered with Crystal, which is actually our usual sort of digital partner for all our meetings. And in fact, the very first European CME forum, they approached us and asked if they could demonstrate their keypad technology on the second day of the meeting. We were so impressed with it, we've stuck with it. And we've gone through sort of this whole digital evolution of going from keypads to iPads to apps, downloadable apps. And Crystal now have developed this online meeting platform, which is called Jam. And it was only running for, it took them quite a few months to build it, but it was only running for a month or two by the time we ran 13 ECF. And because, by that stage, we were all getting Zoom gloom as well. I mean, even now, there's something quite disheartening about someone saying, oh yeah, there's a meeting, it's on Zoom. And you say, oh.
With you there, yeah. So yeah. I can see that that evolution of the use of technology would fit in very nicely with going virtual. So I'm guessing there were some challenges too. I mean, I, from my perspective watching, you know, I think I've seen it in many meetings, like we didn't quite have the kids coming in and interrupting during the presentation. We did have some pretty braggartly displays of bookshelves, we have to say that. And
we had quite a few pets making an appearance, yes, as well. I think there was one workshop dog, where everyone got their dogs to to compare.
Well, was there anything else that you know you could share that would be an idea of what the challenges were?
Yeah, it's certainly, well, the classics of speaker training. Most of us are used to going to conferences, and we know how to interact with each other. We know the etiquette of entering, leaving meeting rooms, how to ask questions. And as speakers, we know how to, you know, develop the slides and deliver our presentations. As speakers, we can see body language and all the sort of nonverbal communication that goes on. And all of this is lost. And it's not just sort of on Zoom. However, even this with this Jam platform, which is so adds a layer of collaboration as well, we do miss the nonverbal communication side. And we've been to these training courses over the years, or maybe those of us of a certain age, where you know, we're coached on how to present and respond to visual cues. But what certainly has been a lesson for me during COVID is there is this even deeper layer of, you know, the sort of the kind of eye rolling or something that you might detect in a room, or someone fiddling with a teaspoon at a table that's not pure sort of body language, but you can tell if you haven't got enough people, your eyes on you while you're presenting. It's not just it's something a bit deeper than body language that I think is missing and that we've all missed. You know, if you're in a really interesting presentation, you can feel the energy in the room. If you're in a dull presentation, you can tell when people have switched off much faster than those sort of traditional cues. So we've lost that. So it's how to replace this. And I think with speakers as well, thinking, oh, I always give 20-minute presentations and 10 minutes Q&A. Which always turns into 27 minutes presentation, 3 minutes Q&A with the chair say, oh, we've got time for one question, terribly sorry. The big lesson we've learned is we really can't go more than 9 minutes for a presentation because people switch off. And in fact, speaking with Crystal and the data that we got from the meeting as well, and you can see that after about 9 minutes, people start to switch off or they start opening their emails or whatever it is. So this is really important. We've got to change it. So from a speaker perspective or people chairing a session, it means managing these the half-hour sessions, 45-minute sessions in 5-minute chunks, for example, where you can actually keep the story going. And it's not like a podcast where people are listening to a conversation. You know, it's quite a passive thing. You know, if people are turning up to a meeting, they need to be engaged in a sort of non-threatening way. We're not forcing people to, you know, they must share their opinion or something or do a test, but just to have the ability, as they would in a normal meeting environment, you'll have the people who are more outspoken, more confident, more involved, but you've got the observers or the newcomers or the people who are just there out of interest, who don't particularly want to be thrown into the middle of a discussion and a debate, but whatever structure there is, and the technology can help, but it's also down to the planning of the meeting, the actual educational design, as it were, has to allow for people to be as involved or in an observer capacity as they choose.
Well, I concur with that, and you know, for someone who doesn't like role play, for example, but I certainly don't mind being involved in conversations. Now, one of the things, and we may expand on this later on, that you just said there makes me think of one of the takeaways that we can think about from the meeting that I found interesting was, and it was partly to do with a presentation, was this whole concept of micro learning. And so if you're talking about the 9-minute chunks, I think that fits very nicely in there. So perhaps we can discuss that later. An aspect of the meeting too was the collaboration or link with the Journal of European CME. And I think it would be important to, again, sort of just talk about what is the connection? First of all, what's the journal? What's its focus? How is it set up? And how does it link in with the European CME Forum?
Sure, yeah. So it was after two or three years of running the annual meetings, we just identified that there was a real call for a journal in Europe, to actually raise the level of academic discussion about medical education, in the continuing education space. And Europe really wasn't served in any way, really, for having sort of open CME dialogue. The papers that were published were really going into specialist journals, so the oncologists, could come up with a report and it would be there. Of course, it wouldn't be in a high-profile part of their journal. It could be in an annex somewhere. And usually behind a paywall as well. So it was very important for us to actually set up a journal that was the highest credibility possible, so a peer review journal, but also for it to be open access. And at that time, and it was over 10 years ago now, when it was at the end of one of the meetings, I sort of announced, we actually had a vote. Because a lot of times when we come up with an idea, we'll put the concept to the room for discussion, and we actually voted, and the majority of the people in the room said yes, set up a journal. It would be good. We think we might be able to submit something, because it's not normal. Europeans are not predisposed really to publishing too much of their work, and certainly not 10 years ago. But there was someone working for a publisher in the room who actually then said it must be open access. That's the new thing. People will probably not pay for this. If this is going to be a niche area, then the subscription model journals are unlikely to succeed. So we were grateful for that input. Then it was to find a publisher that dealt with open access publishing. And so we started our journal, but JECME, Journal of European CME, is the journal of the European CME Forum. It's owned by us, run by us, and from the beginning, the editor in chief is Professor Robin Stevenson, who at the time was just coming to the end of his term of chairing the European Board for Accreditation in Pneumology, Pulmonology, Respiratory Medicine. And so highly experienced in CME. He was also on the UEMS task forces and was well known in the CME sphere. And he took on the editor-in-chief role for the journal, which he still carries on with today. And together we've grown the journal from sort of publishing a few articles to actually getting the critical mass required to be PubMed indexed as well. And what was important is that, like the European CME Forum, we like to focus on the practicalities of doing medical education. We try and cut through the jargon. Europeans especially, or people outside of North America, really do not have the academic background and rigor that that the North Americans have. So, we can't be seen to be competing with JSEP, for example. And Robin's had spoken with all the editors in chief of JSEP over the years to actually just to be clear on each other's positions, that that JECME really is a more practical journal. It's the kind of journal that authors should submit their work that doesn't meet the requirements of JSEP, to consider JECME, but to be also a step above. So it gives the academic rigor to the publications, but it's not a magazine, or that, there's certain, like the Almanac in the US. So to offer Europeans and people outside of Europe, we have plenty of submissions from North America as well as around the world to the journal, to allow people to share their ideas and experiences in this open access environment.
Well, yeah, and just to clarify, JSEP is the Journal of Continuing Education in the Health Professions. And for full disclosure, I am on the editorial board of the Journal of European CME. And I know the answer to this question, but I think it'd be important for in this context for you to kind of say a bit more about it. That last year, there was a call put out for a special collection of articles. This was for the first time for JECME, and the the editor-in-chief that you just mentioned, Robin Stevenson, and Don Moore from Vanderbilt University, a guru in CME, was the guest editor. Perhaps you'd just say a bit more about this, the collection, and actually how it linked into what happened at the European CME Forum for 2020.
Yeah, no, actually we had a board meeting of JECME, and we were sort of brainstorming how can we actually encourage more submissions to the journal. And at that time, ACCME were coming out with their revised accreditation with commendation criteria. And there was that sort of idea of, tell us your story, for providers to actually share their story of their project and to publish this in some way, whether it's just a written letter submission to description, or and then what we started discussing as a board, saying, well, what about if we encourage providers to actually write up their work to an academic standard that's acceptable for JECME, that they could share their experiences with the outside world. And we talked to a number of groups as well, because obviously talked to the heads of grant offices, drug companies, who also informed us that they actually look more favorably on grant applications, or some companies do, if there is some kind of dissemination portion. We're saying, well, what about if we include JECME in this as well? So this special collection sort of came about through from a number of directions, but overall it was a good idea to actually have something. And what is the overarching theme that we're all interested in with CME? Now, that standard question of, does CME work? What kind of results do you expect? What kind of outcomes would we achieve? So the 2020 special collection was all about, was focused on outcomes, and Don Moore agreed to be the guest editor, which was fantastic as the outcomes guru, really, with his outcomes framework. And we thought we'll give it a frisson of excitement as well by saying, okay, Don, why don't you select a small number of authors that we also interview at the 13th Annual European CME Forum. Doesn't matter where they are in the world, it's a virtual meeting now. So we then went back to the authors and invited a number of them to take part in a discussion with Don. So it's a case of the authors now have done their work, they've published it in JECME, and it's an additional benefit to then be on camera discussing their work with Don Moore at the meeting. And it was great to have that further insight from the authors with a bit more information about what they did. And on top of this, and while we were doing the special collection, we also designed and implemented the landing area, the mini website, which actually gives a bit more background. So you can see the call for papers for the 2021 special collection, interviews with the guest editors. There's the original interview with Robin as well about the journal. And it sort of guides the reader and the potential authors to the journal in those pages. And so with the special collection, that really prompted us to create this area just to help readers and ultimately just to improve the dialogue and conversation about CME.
Well, I think that's another example of this kind of, if you like, transparency and accessibility that you've provided through the journal and the forum, so that all of the information that people could ever wish for is freely available. So, I've got a question that comes to mind, which may be difficult for you because you've obviously got a vested interest, but just I wonder, what did you personally get out of 13 ECF in terms of what were the main things that you took away from the meeting?
I would say it was as rewarding as doing the in-person meeting, other than the interpersonal contacts that we were discussing before. Of course, there's nothing that beats actually meeting with friends and colleagues, not just at the CME forums, but of course we do meet at many other meetings as well. So, but from a content perspective and contact with people, I found that, I think from a personal perspective, I did struggle a bit, I think, like so many people during COVID times, just thinking, where are things going? What would we be doing next? Has CME been put on hold? The communication seemed to have closed down. As we heard during the meeting, a lot of CME in Europe was, someone pressed the pause button. But I think we, by the end of the year, I think by November and by the end of this meeting, I felt really energized to get together with colleagues, with other stakeholders in CME to actually compare notes and go, yeah, we all face these challenges, but you know what? We together, we can actually get going with CME. And I just felt really reinvigorated with this meeting. So the topics were really sort of positive, and yeah, the positivity was fantastic.
Well, I think I found one of the main things was that that there may not be an immediate return to the what we'll call the live meetings. So they're all live, but it may be some kind of blended approach, a hybrid type of meeting that will be occurring for the foreseeable future. But definitely the whole idea of collaboration, I think, rose to the surface, and that more and more of the stakeholders in Europe are really interested in the idea of working together for the aim that we all have of improving public health, if that really is our aim, which I think is pretty true.
Now, because that's something that we have seen over the past few years at European CME Forum is something that you've seen clearly in the States, and I see this each time going to an alliance meeting, any meeting in the US, that idea of competitors getting together and collaborating. In the US, no one even calls them competitors, but wearing a European hat, I remember the first time I went to a meeting in the US, I found it really strange that you could have 5, 6, 7 providers in a room all comparing their experiences, the lessons that they've learned, how to do things better. And it really goes against that. So the European protectionism that goes on between companies. You say, oh, no, this is proprietary. You can't possibly discuss state secrets with your enemy, you know, this kind of thing. But we did have a bit of that in the early years of European CME Forum. But I think we have been shown by US contributors, and we have many US presenters on the faculty, and actually showing how these collaborations work. And now it's quite... It's now become normalized in the past decade that people actually do share best practice. And we do have many more Europeans actually stepping up and sharing their experiences. I mean, we could do a lot more. I think if we had Robin on this conversation, he would quickly say, we need many, many more Europeans actually sharing their papers with the journal. But you know, we are getting there. And that's a valuable lesson we've learned by this sort of international approach to the structure of the meeting.
Right. Well, you and your organization are part of what's called the Good CME Practice Group. And maybe that just leads right into to you explaining what is the Good CME Practice Group and what have you done in terms of dealing with the situation we're all in through the pandemic?
Actually, the Good CME Practice Group actually is a good example of providers. It's a group of professional providers. We usually have between like 13 and 17 members year on year. They're for organizations based in Europe. Actually, any provider organization can join. So it can be, you know, the usual sort of medical education provider, can be a medical society, can be a publisher, can be a PCO, you know, professional congress organizer, if they are actually looking after content of the meetings. And you can go to gcmep.org and see the requirements. And actually, in the past year, we've just opened up an associate membership status for joining GCMEP. The organization still has to be based in Europe, but it can be any sort of aspirational organization. So we're trying to open the dialogue just to have like-minded organizations coming together to discuss the shared challenges that education providers face. So it started off actually as, again, about 10 years ago, around the same time as JECME, there was an RFP that came out for a smoking cessation education program that was pan-European, and quite a few education providers responded to this. And we were talking to each other, you know, as one does, about this new RFP. It was innovative. It was the first time something like this was offered sort of in Europe as a sort of this US style approach is how we thought of it. But none of our CME circuit succeeded in getting through to the further rounds. And it transpired, actually, that that something non-compliant took place in this thing. And the accreditation body involved was upset. The learners who got involved was upset because this project was actually awarded to a London-based PR agency that does promotion, that does no education in the way that we know it, no continuing education. But of course, they do the promotional education, usually to members of the public or the profession. So this is what sparked the creation of the group, saying, how can this miscommunication have taken place? So we looked at this and created the Good CME Practice Group. And the first thing that the group did, we spent about 2 years coming up with a joint statement that we should ask the drug companies and the accreditation bodies to use the same terminology, really, when referring to industry-funded, grant-funded education that's accredited for CME. And that open letter is still available on gcmep.org, where we wrote to FPIA, Secretary General of FPIA, and the President and the Secretary General of UEMS, to say, please get together to come up with a common language when it comes to grant-supported CME. And around that time as well, the group came up with the four core principles of Good CME. We thought it wouldn't be appropriate to publish it in our own journal, JECME, so we submitted it to a different journal, a CMRO, and paid for the publication to be open access, so that people, you know, to this day, you can go to it, and we still, all the work of the Good CME Practice Group really is based on those four core principles. And the group gives presentations at European CME forums over the year, as well as other conferences as well, to talk about the practical ways that education organizations can design, deliver education in sort of more, let's call it, everyday language. So it's not using the high academic language, because we want to be as inclusive as possible and to improve the operation of CME in Europe.
And collaborate too, presumably, because the process you talked about there, I was actually involved in the smoking cessation project in the USA, which was with 9 organizations. It was a huge enterprise. And one of the things that always makes me smile a little bit is that we achieved something which might not sound too much, but it was quite remarkable in that. You probably know about NASCAR, which is the saloon car racing in North America. We managed to get a raceway, which was, and NASCAR is often sponsored by tobacco companies. We managed to get the raceway to ban smoking in the grandstands at a NASCAR raceway through this collaborative project. So yeah, these things can work.
This needs to be encouraged and not just dictated. So for years, there are some accreditation bodies in Europe that say they will only accredit activities that's multiple supported, but they're sort of just making the demand. And it's quite straightforward to do it if you're a medical society. But in those days, as a individual education company, as a CME provider, actually it was verging on impossible to actually work in collaboration with another organization, because they were either competitors and not interested in talking to you, or they would be too remote from sort of the CME objectives. And there wasn't that sort of joined up thinking, the common terminology and dialogue that took place. Now, of course, it's much easier. But I have to say, this is one of the positives of the drug companies have brought to CME in Europe, is actually by issuing RFPs that promotes collaborations, and not just between education companies, but exactly the kind of example that you've just given, Ron, get people to think outside the box and come up with solutions, come up with activities that actually look towards improving ultimately sort of public health. But it's not just educating people on medical stuff. You know, CME is much more than that. And this really is our work at the moment, is through these collaborations and actually talking to the non-traditional players, is certainly in the UK, and I suspect in every country across Europe. You know, the kind of people who look at outcomes within, you know, health outcomes, whether it's in the community or in hospitals, things, they are so disconnected from the education portion, whether it's the hospital-led education, whether it's undergraduate education, specialist training, CME, the accreditors, there is such a disconnect between the two. And yet that's what we as a CME community are looking towards, is improving public health. Why aren't our players, the various stakeholders involved in CME in Europe, not knocking on the doors of those organizations saying, you've got all the data, we know how to do the gap analysis and to close it in some way, we know how to bring the collaborations together, let's start talking. So I'm seeing this as, you know, looking 5 years hence, that I would like to see some of those actors actually being involved in European CME forum meetings and to build these kind of collaborations that we see going on in the US much more.
Well, and kind of related to that, I suppose, is something that's occurred at the European CME Forum over the last few years has been a focus on interprofessional education. And I think it would be useful to let people know how they can access the information that is there that was available during the forum for those who weren't actually in attendance, or as a review for those who were in attendance.
Sure. So, yeah, as you've already mentioned, you know, all the past presentations, as in the PowerPoints available as PDFs, are available on cmeforum.org, on that website. For the 13th meeting, because we were doing this virtually, we created a meeting book that was online. So there's an actual website called cmesummit.org. So if you go into that website and just think of it as the meeting book, but of course it's sort of living, breathing as well, because we had the elevator pitches, you know, that we've asked all the session leaders and especially the workshop leaders to record a short description of their session to actually try and entice people to their sessions when they were run competitively. Or just to give people an introduction to their session. So we've got that. This podcast is what has a lot of highlights from 13ECF as well. So we've edited some highlights from 13ECF, which are available as sound bites, and also on our YouTube channel, which is accessible from cmeforum.org. So we've got snippets of information. We have your excellent report, Ron, which people can go to, and you've reported all the key takeaways and highlights from each of the sessions. So that's available from jecme.org. So there are a number of ways, depending on whether you want to read about it, listen to it, or watch videos, to actually see what happened at 13ECF. But you mentioned specifically about interprofessional education. So IPC is a new concept in Europe. The terminology, I remember I went to a meeting, I was meeting in Oxford, and Kathy Chappell was there, and Kate Dragnier as well. So on the joint accreditation side of things, and of course they are very involved in IPCE. So coming to the conference in Oxford, and so it was hosted by the UK, and it was just interesting to hear their conversation about how even the terminology IPCE hasn't been standardized. But of course, interprofessional education takes place. We have in Europe, certainly in the UK, I think it's in the field of oncology, where we see sort of this interprofessional interplay, you know, with the multidisciplinary teams. I think they're called multidisciplinary, but it's really interprofessional because they'll bring in the ancillary staff, certainly the nursing, different types of clinicians, doing the reviews each week. And we're seeing this now in other areas of medicine, but within European CME Forum, you know, the IPCE messages are there. You can see the previous presentations, and it's great to have. Yeah, we don't quite have the role plays that you're not quite such a fan of, nor me, but to go through this and actually discuss the challenges that are there, because we're still in many countries, even in North America, the idea of the senior physician, the senior doctor, is obviously the boss of the discussion. You know, have this sort of paternalistic approach to the healthcare team. Seems we've got a role in CME to actually help educate these teams, you know, the team-based approach to education.
Well, there are some examples of this actually happening in Europe. And I would point out something called the Schwartz Grand Rounds, which have come into hospitals in Britain and in Ireland over the last few years. And they've been in the US for quite a while now, where you get the whole care team and others who may not be directly involved in the clinical side of things coming together and discussing things in a non-clinical way. And I think that's a really nice model for just what you've described there, you know?
Yeah. And that was fantastic. And in fact, Ron, that it was when you mentioned the Schwartz rounds that we did some investigations for the Dublin meeting, which is the 10th meeting in 2017. Right. And through that, we invited Juanita Guidera in Ireland to actually present in Dublin. She ran a fantastic session. And she actually works for a quality improvement division in Ireland. So there is that sort of joining up there.
Yeah.
And that was great. Yeah. So with a nursing background and really illustrated to the room some great concepts that are already in play in Ireland. So yeah, actually, thank you for reminding me that it does take place a little bit in Europe, but yeah, we've got a way to go. Yeah.
Right. So this may be kind of treading on your toes for what you usually do at the beginning of the forum, but is there anything that's happened in the world of CME, CPD, any sort of drastic changes that you've seen since November 2020?
Thank you for putting me on the spot there, Rob. There are certain things that I'm encouraged by and disappointed by, etc. But I try not to say anything so too publicly before the meeting itself until, you know, we have, because I like to validate these things with other people. So right now I'm having a lot of discussions with speakers and session leaders about what they see are sort of, you know, the challenges and what the future is looking like from their perspective. And we'll design sessions around their experiences. So yeah, from what I'm seeing, I'd like to discuss with people who are more expert in this field and keep structuring the program for 14 ECF in that way. But certainly, you know, the sort of the word on the ground, what I'm hearing so far is we really do need to look at the CME environment in Europe. I mean, from a personal perspective, and I don't know how high up this would be in the priorities for other people, we are seeing the way education is accredited. I feel that the accreditors are dragging their heels a little bit. We have learned in COVID so much in the past year and a half that people do not want to sit through an hour's worth of education. Why are the accreditors insisting on 1 hour for one credit? Yes, they're starting to say, oh, we can do smaller chunks of education and things. They're sort of still trying to control from above how education providers deliver their education. You know, that we have plenty of companies. We see this in the Good CME Practice Group, good companies that need to have their education accredited, and they are developing their education according to the accreditation standards. And it's like sometimes trying to shove a round peg into a square hole. What I love about the ACCME system is that it allows the providers to sort of sit down, have the brainstorm, develop the education that's most suited for your particular target audience in that clinical situation, whatever it may be. And then once you sort of develop the education, saying, is this certifiable for CME credit? And the answer is yes, because, you know, even in recent years, the dialogue we've seen between the ACCME and the AMA, even that AMA classification of other, you know, it's not a live event, it's not this, that, the other. You can classify it as an other activity. As long as it's a good quality educational activity and you're measuring the outcomes from it, give it CME credit. So all this stuff about micro-learning and stuff, you know, putting labels onto different types of education, I think is sort of laboring the point. We're swimming through this treacle of having to define what we're doing rather than just do what we're doing. Give it credit, and whether it's a quarter credit, half a credit. So there needs to be some catch up there. But usually, you know, regulators, the rules, the laws of the land usually follow really the practice of what's going on in everyday life. So I'm hoping that they will sort of listen and take note from providers. From the provider's side, it's become hugely competitive, hasn't it, with COVID times. You know, our learners are now the ultimate consumers. They are spoiled for choice. In many cases, there's a lot of good quality stuff out there. So I think providers are raising their game. We're seeing that, you know, the one and done, you know, flash in the pan kind of education. I'm hoping it's seeing its dying day, you know, that one-off RFP for a single activity. You know, now we can see from the RFPs from drug companies, they're asking for a series of things, you know, year-long or two-year-long programs. And for providers, because especially in Europe with GDPR and all this data protection, we need to look after and nurture our target audience, our database, as it were, make sure that we are satisfying their educational needs. So this means also, from a provider perspective, we now need to plan our education primarily rather than responding to an RFP or responding to the requirements of an accreditation body. So I'm seeing this changing over the past year. And on the negative side, I think, and I would like to see evidence of this more, and that's why I'm saying I would like to speak to the experts about this. I wonder what the level of funding for CME has become in the past 12 months compared to the level of funding of promotional education through Medcoms agencies. Now, that's a multi-billion euro industry in Europe. We must hit €1 billion. The sizes of these organizations are increasing hugely. I don't think some were struggling in the early days, like all companies, but on the whole, the Medcoms agencies that have survived the early days of COVID are now really thriving. There's a lot of money going in, and there are a lot of questions about, you know, when I'm talking about the associate memberships of the good CME practice group, you know, Medcoms agencies are looking around, how can they get their education accredited for CME? It's possible in certain countries that promotional organizations can get their programs accredited for CME. From a personal perspective, from a, let's say, a CME accreditation body perspective, from a global grants office perspective, I think this could well be a threat to the CME space. And we need to have this discussion about, you know, where is this line drawn? At what point, how far can drug companies be involved in, control, present accredited CME in Europe? Because in Europe, across Europe and many places, it is still possible for this to happen. So from a good CME practice group perspective, we see this as a threat. But I think this could be driven by the amount of funding that is going towards each of these sectors. So it's quite a contentious, it's always a contentious point year on year, but it's something that I would like to bring out in 14 ECF and continue the discussion, because we discuss it every year on year. Drug companies have got a lot to offer. They've got fantastic educationalists now on staff. And they've always developed high quality education. Medical societies now, we're seeing for educationalists joining their staff as well. And they are walking sort of that line between working in collaboration with drug companies or taking arm's length support in order to develop what they're doing internally. There's a balance going on there. And of course, education providers raised a lot of questions about different routes for CME accreditation. And of course, what we were talking about right at the beginning of this podcast about you know, the actual requirements for CME credit, CPD credit in Europe. What's going to happen with that? I don't have a sense of what the regulators are saying across Europe. I'd like to hear more in the coming months.
Well, I wonder if there's any way that you might consider the different types of CME, CPD that are available, if we can see more of them happening in Europe. For example, things like point of care or more workplace-based education. I know that these topics were brought up at 13 ECF, and it's been an ongoing discussion, I think, over the years about why many educational, I mean, why many hospitals and clinics and so on don't actually have a CME CPD department that's responsible for that, because much of the best education may happen in an informal way during the work going on in the workplace, or meetings that wouldn't normally be providing education that's accredited, but there's no reason why they shouldn't.
Absolutely. No, yeah, and you've hit on two very important points here. Yeah, the informal learning and the what goes on a point of care and the education departments in hospitals. You know, as an education provider, you know, myself, in talking to faculty, it's a real heart sink moment when you're talking to a highly skilled clinician and they say, oh, yes, I like doing CME things. I like keeping up to date with what the juniors are learning. And there isn't that sort of connection between their own educational needs and their own clinical practice. They're sort of keeping up to date by educating the juniors. And this is normal, I'm sure, across the world. But for there to be a structure to actually educate our learners, however senior they may be, that it's really important to keep up to date, to have this sort of formalized in some way, or at least have a program available in the hospital where we have that language around using the CME nomenclature, really, so that people can say, oh yeah, I did the grand rounds and it can count for my CME credit. I mean, I'm sure it can in a lot of places, but for it to be easily recognized as such, and especially the informal learning, the shorter interactions, and we're starting to see now in Europe the accreditation of the point of care sort of dictionaries and resources that clinicians can use, and the micro learning that happens on these educational apps. But for this to be expanded, really, so that really the whole sort of the house of medicine, the practicing clinicians actually are aware that there are a number of fun ways and more relevant ways that they can engage in CME. And it's not just that default, oh, I have to sit in a lecture theatre for hour on end in order to get that certificate.
Well, I'm sure we may be talking about some of these things in the 14 ECF, and you've indicated that there's some things you may be discussing about the changes that have occurred since last year. And again, going back to this whole concept that you have of accessibility and transparency, is it possible for folk to be able to kind of be up to date with where the plans are for 14 ECF? How do they access that information?
Sure. So always on the website, cmeforum.org/14ECF. We'll have all the latest publicly available information there. Now, we are about to announce more details about the theme and how we're executing it. Yeah, so the theme for 14 ECF will be the three-legged stool, achieving balance for effective CME. So with 13 ECF, you know, we approach that meeting by looking at by stakeholder group. So we had six sessions there. We had a JECME session. We had a session each for the medical societies, the accreditors, drug companies, professional providers, and then we had a sort of like our traditional UN-session where we had a panel discussion. So for this year, we are going to have the JECME session and then look at the three legs of a stable stool of CME. And some detail is available on the website. And I think in the next week or so, when we come out with more information, you can either get it there. But I hope, Ron, that we'll be able to meet again and maybe have a discussion about that and get to get into the nuts and bolts of how the meeting is coming together.
Well, I hope so too, and I think that you know, the 13 ECF was definitely different, but I, as an attendee who's been at many of these and had to really pay attention because you've asked me to write up a report, found it in many ways the ability to have everything recorded was wonderful in terms of being able to go back and analyze and extract information that I needed to write up the report. So for me, it was in some ways it was more beneficial than having to concentrate at the time, writing everything down, taking my notes at the time, even though I did that. So I do think the idea of the hybrid model is going to be what we're seeing for a couple of years anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we'll still be Well, we'll talk about more details about 14 ECF. We're not going hybrid because travel restrictions won't be unrestricted sort of enough. But certainly in future years, I think all meetings will have to be hybrid in some way. But yeah, we're trying to respond quickly. And I should also mention, you know, to stay up to date, you know, make sure you're if people can be following us on Twitter. You know, we're very active on Twitter and LinkedIn as well, where we're directing people to the relevant parts of our resource sections and latest information. And every couple of days there's new information, and certainly weekly. We've got the weekly podcasts going out, and the LinkedIn channel certainly is the best way to keep up to date on an ongoing basis, rather than waiting for our sort of monthly emails, because of course, you know, sign up to our email list as well to make sure you get that. But at least you can interact with the information that we announce in the ways that people are most comfortable with.
Well, I tell you what, Eugene, let's meet again soon and talk about 14 ECF in a bit more detail. Would that work?
That sounds great. Let's do that, Ron. Thanks very much.
Okay, take care. See you soon.
That was Ron Murray, independent CME CPD consultant, joining me to discuss the previous meeting of the European CME Forum. Ron Murray recently published the 13th annual European CME Forum conference report in JECME, and it's freely available to read at the journal's website, jecme.org. JECME is the PubMed-indexed, open-access journal of the European CME Forum, publishing articles that address aspects of CME CPD planning, design, delivery, assessment and regulation. If you'd like to learn more about last year's meeting, you can register for this year's 14th annual meeting and gain access to the complete archive of the 13th annual European CME Forum, consisting of all the plenary and workshop sessions with over 18 hours of CME CPD content from a faculty of 70 experts in European and global CME. More information on the upcoming 14th Annual European CME Forum and this year's JECME Special Collection can be found on our website, cmeforum.org. Thank you for listening, and join us for more episodes as we explore all things CME CPD.